Hey everyone, and welcome to this, the first ever edition of the Seriously Risky Business podcast. My name's Patrick Gray. Seriously Risky Business is, of course, the newsletter that Tom Uren writes for us here at Risky Biz HQ every week. It is a newsletter that deals mostly with policy matters, that is, cybersecurity and intelligence issues that are of interest to government officials and policymakers. And yeah, we just thought some of you out there might like to hear Tom and I discuss the main themes that have come up in the newsletter each week in podcast form. I should mention, Seriously Risky Business is made possible thanks to the support of the Hewlett Foundation's Cyber Initiative and through sponsorships from Proofpoint, CyberCX, and OstCyber. So big thanks to all of you for making this work possible. So, Mr. Tom Uren, first of all, welcome. And let's talk about the two major stories or major themes that you wrote about this week. One of them deals with the establishment of cyber norms in espionage through prosecutorial decisions. I guess that's the simplest way to describe that one. But the other one is the one we're going to talk about first, which is some work you did looking at how TikTok is trying to unscramble its data omelet. So BuzzFeed ran a story a few days back looking at some leaked recordings that came out of ByteDance, which showed that they're having trouble trying to separate US user data from the Chinese operations of TikTok, which is, of course, owned by ByteDance, which is a Chinese company. Hence all of that controversy a couple of years ago when, you know, Trump was looking at banning them and all of that. But I suppose the TLDR here is that it turns out it's quite difficult to try to ring fence social media data when, you know, you're a global network, right?
Yeah, I think the story there is that companies build their products with a goal in mind. And the goal is to get more users and make $1 billion. And the goal is not to carefully look at what data we're getting and put it in the right buckets and keep it separate. Like, that's, I think, probably part of the reason that government efforts to run IT projects are so slow. They take their time to think about what we can do and what we can't do. They don't just chuck it all in the same bucket. I suppose it's worth considering why we care about TikTok. So the real problem there is that pretty much every Chinese tech company that's worth its salt is basically beholden to the Chinese Communist Party. So in the article, I talk about how the CEO of ByteDance, which is TikTok's parent company, several years ago published, you know, a groveling apology, basically, where he said that, you know, he'd failed to respect socialist core values and he'd deviated from public opinion guidance.
I mean, I was surprised when you turned up that quote, because I didn't remember having seen that in the past, where he's basically denouncing himself.
Right? Yeah, that's right.
And saying, I'm sorry, I've been a bad communist, you know?
Yeah. So ByteDance ran, I think it was a kind of news aggregator, and it's similar to TikTok in that it was algorithm driven. This caused problems for the Communist Party in that it was highlighting the wrong kind of news. Yeah. That's my understanding. Yeah. I'm not.
There was a bit of wrong speak on that platform.
Yeah, exactly. Right? And so the way you get that under control is you issue a groveling apology and make sure you never do it again. So what really leapt out to me about this story is that it really struck me as similar to Huawei and the sort of debate we had about the involvement of Chinese companies in critical infrastructure. And as soon as you realize that there's a potential problem with the Chinese Communist Party control and that their interests are not the same as our interests, it's pretty easy to draw a straight line between Huawei, centrally involved in critical infrastructure, therefore we must have risk mitigations. But for TikTok, TikTok's not critical infrastructure, and people don't even seem to be really able to know what the real problem is. So there's one aspect that the story focuses on, which is about user data. And the other aspect, which is less focused on, but actually Trump's executive order about TikTok mentions this, it's that it could be used to sway political opinion. And my reading of it is that Trump actually disliked TikTok because activists organized against him on TikTok.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty transparent that he was into this for the wrong reasons. I mean, from my perspective, like I understand that TikTok's not critical infrastructure, and I understand that the and something you point out in the story too, in your analysis, is that TikTok actively curates trends on its platform, right? So it's not all organic. They've got a team of moderators sitting there going, okay, this trend looks interesting, let's give it a boost. So they're very hands-on with the content. But I thought I'd provide an example of some intelligence that would be available to the CCP via TikTok data. TikTok asks you for permission to access your address book every 10 minutes, right? I mean, I'm a TikTok user right now. They want your contacts because they want that network graph. Now, obviously they want it for commercial reasons, but that is the sort of information that would be useful to a Chinese intelligence agency in working out who knows who, for example.
Yeah,
and having a really, really comprehensive network graph.
And if I put my conspiracy hat on, it doesn't really make any sense for TikTok to ask you for your social graph, because it's not a social network, it's an interest network. So it's based on serving up things that you're interested in. And so it's not central to what it's doing that it needs those social media contacts.
Yeah, they don't really need it.
Yeah. Yeah. So that you can construct a conspiracy theory on that.
I think it's probably more likely they just went for it because that's what they all do, right? Like, just they want to, you know, more data for the data gods,
it's in the default template for an app.
Yeah. It's the default template for these guys. But I guess, look, the interesting theme is here, I guess, is that, as you pointed out, by the time you've created this omelet, it gets a little bit difficult to unscramble it later. I think what's really coming out of this is that non-US social networks need to think about this stuff on the ground floor. I think that's the big takeaway here, because trying to retrospectively fix this is proving to be quite difficult. So TikTok have this program called Project Texas, which is about trying to ring fence that data, but they had some external consultants come in, and we know this thanks to BuzzFeed's excellent reporting. They had some external consultants coming in pointing out that a lot of the tools that do stuff like provide metrics to the company, like, they're passing around all sorts of American user data through China, and of course the engineers over there have access. The other company, and you didn't mention this in the piece, and I wish you did, because I think there's some relevance there as well, was Kaspersky, right? Because there are all these security concerns around Kaspersky. And then in response to that, they moved their data centers to Switzerland, and they said, look, we've got this big project to put all of this user data and control in a neutral country. And it didn't really do them any good. And I think the reason it didn't do them any good is because ultimately people in Russia would have been able to control and manipulate those servers, even if they were based in Switzerland or Botswana. It didn't really matter. And I think to a degree, we've got the same sort of issue here with TikTok, which is you can have all that data in an Oracle data center in the United States, but it's a Chinese company, and ultimately the Chinese staff are going to be able to access that data if they really want to. So I guess that brings us back to the big question, which is, you know, can you unscramble the omelet? And even if you do unscramble the omelet, does it even matter? And that's the question, isn't it?
Yeah. I think people, like, there's arguments that the type of data that TikTok could provide is already out there for sale anyway. And the Chinese have stolen so much data that, you know, it's an incremental improvement. I don't really buy those arguments entirely. I can sort of see what they're getting at. But I think that probably by moving it to the States, you can prevent the mass wholesale exfiltration of everything. That seems like it'd be just relatively, or at least possible to stop. But it's probably very, very difficult to stop the targeted exfiltration of particular individuals. You know, I'm interested in a particular person.
Yeah, so if someone wanted, like, your contact list or something.
Yeah, that's right.
That is something that
and my view, having from an intelligence person, is, well, just stop those people having accounts. So there's already directives that, you know, the US government and military people can't use it on work phones. So that's the sort of compromise position that you could come up with. And, you know,
see, the problem with this, though, right, when you're talking about a social graph, is TikTok doesn't, as far as I know, doesn't have my contact list, because I didn't give it to them. Right? I keep hitting no, even though I have to do it 10 times a day. Right. I say no. The problem is my friends probably didn't say no.
Yeah.
So their contact lists that I'm in are there. And, you know, that's the thing with these network graphs, is you don't have to hit everyone to get it to build up actually a pretty comprehensive network graph, right?
And I suppose the question is, like, how important is that? Like, on what basis do you decide that that's critically important, that TikTok should be, you know, be regulated in a particular way? Maybe, you know, if that's important, it should just not be able to collect that kind of data. Now, Fergus Ryan, who I spoke to at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, was very much of the view that, and Fergus has written reports about censorship on TikTok and WeChat. So he's an expert on this kind of thing. He was very much of the view that the data is a red herring, and he's much more concerned about the political manipulation on the platform. So going back to them having their hands on the levers, unlike Huawei, you know, critical infrastructure, clearly we can do things because we know what the problem is. TikTok's a situation where, well, there's these two different problems. No one really says one is more important than the other, and there's no metric of deciding how we make that decision.
Yeah, and it's a little bit difficult to surface this type of manipulation given that TikTok is so good at tuning a feed to an individual, right? There are people who love to consume political content on TikTok. I am not one of them. So I like to keep it light, which means I see funny stuff, right? And that's fine. So if they were trying to do push political narratives on someone like me, I'm going to see that because it's going to be out of place in my feed of, you know, dogs doing funny stuff, right? Yeah. Whereas, you know, these really politically engaged people who are easy to fire, I don't know. And I think, though, that yeah, it's an interesting example because it's not critical infrastructure, you know, so it's distinct from Huawei. It's not a computing tool like Kaspersky that's embedded into some very sensitive places. It is one of those things where it's really hard to try to build that case of why it's important, but I still think that there are lessons here for companies that are based outside of the United States that might be in countries that the US doesn't have great relationships with. Because let's be honest, if you're building a global company, the United States is still going to be your biggest market. People really need to think on the ground floor, how do we deal with this issue when we eventually get there? And right now, it almost looks impossible, right? Even if you could manage it from a technology perspective, just organizationally, it's still hard because when you have an offshore parent, they might still have access. I don't know. There's got to be some more business process ring fencing, which just isn't happening at the moment, you know?
Yeah, I talk to people and when it comes to data governance, the commercial world just doesn't care. So I suppose this example is one reason why maybe you should.
Well, look, let's move on to our second story that we're going to talk about this week. And I love the headline you've given this one. Indict more state cyber operators, please. Now, you've written up a story here about the indictment of a GRU cyber operator by the German government indicted this guy, Nikolai Kozacek. And they've indicted him for hacking into a NATO think tank, which isn't something you'd see the American DOJ has been a lot more restrained about these types of indictments. They tend to indict operators from SIGINT agencies or cyber agencies when they go out of bounds, whereas hitting a NATO think tank is kind of bread and butter for this type of collection. So you've done a bit of a deep dive on this. One thing that comes through out of your writing here, which I think is really interesting, is what's legitimate and not legitimate is very much in the eye of the beholder and is an extremely subjective thing, right? So when we talk about shaping these cyber norms, it really is a case that America is trying to shape norms that it thinks should be normal, but there isn't really much consensus and the whole thing's very subjective.
Yeah, well, my view is that espionage is all about what advantages, like what's acceptable in espionage is all about what advantages the people or the countries with the most power have. So for the longest time, international espionage has been accepted because the US was probably the most effective power in that sphere. And so for them, it's a net win. From a Chinese point of view, things like economic espionage make 100% sense. Like they're a big winner out of doing that. Whereas the US had nothing to gain. So there's this tension over, you know, whose rules do we follow?
I've often said sort of controversially that China's campaign of intellectual property theft has done wonders to lift people out of poverty, right? So it's when you look at it from a moral dimension, it's complicated, but you always bring up the same point when I say that, which is that's not why they're doing it. They're just doing it so that they can stay in power. Because you're our in-house cheerful cynic. There are complex equities involved in trying to figure out what a norm should be, I guess is the point.
It
depends where you live.
Yeah, so the US is one of the ways that they tried to enforce norms was by indictments. So I went and looked back at the very first indictments the US had levied against five Chinese People Liberation Army officers, and they were really super clear about what they were trying to do there. The press release is all about economic espionage, economic espionage, economic espionage. This is what we really object to. And that was part of, I guess I'd call it a whole of government effort. The US government was engaged at the most senior levels. They threatened economic sanctions. They made it clear that this was a big deal, that we wanted this to stop. And they eventually got an agreement between Obama and Xi to stop the cyber-enabled theft of intellectual property.
The famed agreement that lasted for about 10 minutes.
And what I think is really interesting, with the intent of providing competitive advantages to companies or commercial sectors. So, I mean, in one sense, I can argue that that agreement still holds, because the Chinese intent is not to provide competitive advantage. The Chinese intent is to prop up the Communist Party. And so it's doing it as a matter of self-preservation rather than commercial advantage. We don't care about the money. We just want our people to be usefully employed so they don't riot.
Yeah, so they don't, so that there's dissent doesn't foment, right?
Yeah, so the they've kind of said, here are these things which are out of bounds. There you go, there's an indictment to go with that. This is our way of trying to enforce rules. The German indictment is like nothing to do with that. It's just, there's this person doing espionage. We don't like it. We're going to charge you. And so I spoke to John Bateman, who's a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment, and just sort of put to him that, you know, the Obama-Xi agreement didn't hold. Therefore, indictments are useless. What's the point? Is the German indictment undercutting US efforts? And John was great to talk to. He thought that, no, indictments can have multiple purposes. Just because that agreement doesn't hold or didn't hold doesn't mean that they're not useful for other purposes, or maybe even for trying to deter states.
Well, he makes the argument too that it's like you got to do this a lot and over time as well. Like, it's not something that works instantly.
Yeah, and I think one thing he said that really struck me is that none of the tools that governments have he didn't use the term silver bullet, but none of them are particularly effective on their own. So when they're not effective on their own, you've got to use them in concert, and you've just got to keep trying to use them. So I think he put it a bit more elegantly than that. But like, that seems fine. That seems perfectly reasonable. And the other point he made is that maybe you can't deter a state. Like, a state's got big goals, and it's not going to be stopped by a couple of people, even if they end up in jail. But perhaps you can sort of on the margins deter individuals. I could go work for an intelligence organization, or I could go get paid elsewhere. Why bother taking that risk?
Yeah, because I don't want to get indicted in the future. I don't know that that's, you know, a big lever you can pull on a lot of people who join those sort of agencies, because they're very serious about their country and stuff like that. Like, yeah, I'm color me a little bit skeptical on that. But I also wanted to bring up too, and this was something that you brought up in this write-up that I thought was fascinating. You know, to the Americans' credit, they didn't really kick up a stink when the OPM breach happened. In fact, we saw off-the-record comments from intelligence people, not off-the-record, but unattributed comments to senior intelligence officials at the time saying, well, this is exactly the sort of thing we do to them. So, you know, we're not going to get all huffy about it, right? So, you know, to America's credit, it didn't kick up a stink. But then you sort of get these cases where it proves how arbitrary the line is between what's acceptable under the norm and what isn't. And the example that you've cited in the newsletter is Equifax, right? Where a whole bunch of information on private citizens, you know, was obtained by the Chinese state, clearly to pad out some of their big data sets and, you know, combine with data that they obtained in things like the OPM hack. And that was charged. Now, William Barr, the Attorney General at the time in the United States, said that, you know, that data had economic value. But that's not really why it was stolen. It was stolen for espionage purposes. So we'd be guessing why this one is over the line, maybe because it's a non-government system, maybe because it involved obtaining data on millions of people who have nothing to do with the US government. But we would be guessing, right?
Because sometimes... I think in the announcement at the time, Barr did talk about why they were indicting, and it was because it involved millions of... I don't think he used the word innocent. And so I guess that means to me that the US interpretation is the target is the thing. It's a government or a military target. Whereas the Chinese interpretation is it's the purpose that's the thing.
Yeah.
So we've got an intelligence purpose. Doesn't care. You know, I don't care who the target is.
What even are they? Right?
Yeah. And I mean, I think that intelligence agencies target people that are not persons of interest, not the primary target, but they'll have, there's probably a word for it. Is it secondary targeting, where you target an entity or someone who has access to information, even though they're not the person you actually care about? So, I mean, those sort of, this is just the same thing on a bigger scale.
Yeah, it is. All right, now, also in the newsletter, those were the two main stories. There were a few shorts in there. Obviously, you covered that Interpol announced that it had cracked down on, you know, something like 1,700 call centers doing fraud, so that was really nice. We also have an item in there about the Dutch. They actually managed to catch a Russian illegal, which is not something that happens every day. Tell us quickly about this one.
Yeah, so a Russian GRU officer had been posing as a Brazilian, and he was trying to get an internship in the International Criminal Court. So the ICC is going to look at potential Russian war crimes in Ukraine, and so this is clearly an intelligence target for the Russians. This is like typical modus operandi. AIVD just tweeted out, "We caught this guy. Here's his fictitious cover." It talks about how the legend that he'd written for himself of, you know, "I grew up in this place, there was fishing nearby and I didn't like the stench of fish, which is why I don't like seafood anymore." So it goes into quite a lot of detail about his history. And I think I just really love that it's, there's no need for AIVD to publish that. It's really just an in your face to the GRU.
Yeah, it's a bit of a middle finger, isn't it? It is. Meanwhile, the Biden White House has Biden signed two new cybersecurity bills over there in the US, Tom.
Yeah, so one seemed to me quite boring, but I really like the Federal Rotational Cyber Workforce Program Act. It's just allowing a sort of development program for cybersecurity professionals to travel through different organizations doing different jobs. And it's kind of a broadening thing that I think will actually make cybersecurity better, but also give people better careers in federal service.
All right. Now, of course, there are a bunch of other items linked to from the Seriously Risky Business newsletter that, you know, if anyone wants to check out the newsletter, hit up risky.biz/subscribe, and you can find links to all of our podcasts and newsletters there. But Tom, you ran. That's it for our first ever edition of the Seriously Risky Business podcast, mate. Thank you so much for doing it with me, and I'll chat to you again soon.
Great, Pat. Thanks. It was a blast.